Hello, you're listening to Micronews, the podcast where Laura and I talk about some of the times microbes and microbiology has been in the news this month. Sadly, after Boris Johnson's announcement, we are once again recording this remotely, but hopefully we'll be back in the office in the not too distant future. So Laura, do you want to kick off?
Now, on the face of it, this story sounds like it's bad news, but I actually think it has a really shiny silver lining. Within days of becoming available, access to the flu vaccine had to be limited due to high demand. Usually, the flu vaccine is made freely available to a wide group of people, with many others choosing to get the vaccine privately done at pharmacies. A number of people are prioritised for the vaccine, including healthcare workers, the elderly, and vulnerable groups such as people with pre-existing conditions. This year, due to the ongoing SARS-CoV-2 pandemic, people have been encouraged to get the flu vaccine so they can reduce the burden of flu season on the NHS and protect the most vulnerable. I mean, I for one think it's fantastic that so many people are taking public health more seriously and signing up to get the vaccine. These vaccines were only made available earlier this month, and there are still plenty of stocks available, according to NHS England. Up to 30 million people can be vaccinated in the UK this year, which is huge compared to the typical uptake of around 10 million. This is just a result of high demand early in the vaccination window, whilst usually vaccines are delivered to pharmacies and GP surgeries in batches throughout autumn. The vaccine has to be delivered in batches because it needs to be refrigerated, and there is only so much fridge space on site. Since the circulating strain of influenza virus changes every single year, the whole process of developing and manufacturing the flu vaccine annually is an enormous logistical challenge, and really is a global effort. I actually made a podcast on the process in February 2019, so if you're interested, go and check it out in the link in the podcast description below.
We've mentioned plankton a few times on the show, but I don't think we've ever defined them. It can be tricky, as plankton are defined by their ecological niche rather than any phylogenetic or taxonomic classification. Basically, the definition of plankton are organisms that can't swim against the ocean's currents and so drift along with them. But there are also different groups within plankton, for example, meroplankton, those that are plankton for a small portion of their lifestyle, usually the larval stage, for example, crabs, and holoplankton, those that are always plankton. They can be microscopic or huge, like jellyfish. Also, as a quick side note, a singular plankton is known as a planktre, which I find kind of pleasing. But why am I telling you all of this? Well, scientists are questioning the future of the Arctic, as growth patterns of plankton in Arctic waters are changing quite dramatically. The growth rate of phytoplankton, which is microscopic photosynthetic algae, has increased by 57% between 1998 and 2018. As phytoplankton are at the bottom of the food chain, it may appear like this is a good thing, more food. Scientists are saying this is a symptom of climate change. As the ice melts, there is more room for the plankton to grow. But now the increase in growth rate is no longer caused by this sea ice decline. Nutrients are coming into the Arctic from outside sources and allowing the phytoplankton to bloom, creating what scientists are calling a thickening algal soup. Now, you may think this is good because it provides more food, but it's not the case. Other organisms tend to have specific times they can eat, and if these blooms come at the wrong time, it can throw relationships between other species further up the food chain completely out of whack, potentially affecting their ability to eat, breed, and survive. Which isn't great, but it also massively affects us from an economical point, because it can completely change which fish stocks might be available at what times. So it's kind of worrying.
I thought you'd be quite excited about this next one, because I know it's something you've covered a lot on Microbe Talk and also on our blog. There was an article about phage in The Guardian this month. For the listeners at home who may not know what bacteriophage, or phage for short, are, they are the viruses that are the natural predators of bacteria. Now, phage have quite an interesting history. They were discovered in 1917, and up until the Second World War, before antibiotics became more widely used, they were the main therapy for bacterial infections. Now, once again, phage are becoming an important therapy against bacterial infections due to the global increase in antibiotic resistance. This piece contained interviews with a number of experts, including Toby Nagel, a biomedical engineer who launched an organisation called Phage for Global Health in 2014. The primary purpose of Phage for Global Health is to help developing countries fight antimicrobial resistance following Toby's disillusionment with the inequality of access to medicines. The great thing about phage therapy is that it is more targeted to the specific bacteria involved in an infection, and it can be quicker and cheaper to develop. These properties not only make phage therapy an ideal candidate for use in developing countries, but also mean that there are fewer side effects and less disruption of natural microbiota. I actually really enjoyed this article, and it even includes some input from one of our members, Professor Martha Clokey. Martha visited Tanzania on a Microbiology Society grant last year. You're currently editing together a video blog from her time there, right?
I am indeed. So Martha goes to Tanzania and she puts on courses for local academics that want to learn a bit more about phage. The last time she went, she did some filming for us, and I'm putting together the video, as you said. I think it's a really interesting insight into her work, so make sure you keep an eye out for that.
That sounds great. I actually can't wait to see it.
My next story was fairly widely covered and is pretty incredible. Venus is one of the last planets in the solar system scientists expected to find evidence of life. It's a pretty hostile place. It has a dense, superheated atmosphere of carbon dioxide lurking below thick clouds of sulfuric acid. Because of the super high levels of carbon dioxide, Venus has experienced a runaway greenhouse effect, and the temperature on the surface is over 400 degrees. That's hot, like really hot. So hot that lead would melt. When this was discovered, the dream of finding life there was pretty much forgotten. However, with the increased research into extremophiles, those incredible organisms that can withstand some of the most hostile environments Earth has to offer, the dream was reignited. Extremophiles are truly incredible microorganisms. If you want to learn a little bit more about them, we have a content hub all about life at the extremes, which includes a video on extremophiles. I'll leave a link below. But back to Venus. Scientists have become really excited as they have discovered phosphine in the atmosphere of Venus. Now, phosphine is a molecule that's made up of one phosphorus atom and three hydrogen atoms. On Earth, phosphine is associated with life, like microbes living in the guts of animals like penguins, or in oxygen-poor environments such as swamps. Now scientists have found it in Venus's atmosphere and can't explain it. The gas can be made industrially, but there's no factories on Venus. Given the conditions on Venus, no scientists have been able to provide a way for the gas to be there abiotically, so the theory of life creating the gas could be very plausible. People are sceptical, and understandably. The clouds above Venus are about 75 to 95% sulfuric acid, which is a pretty difficult place to survive if you have a cellular structure. They could hide themselves away inside a protective shell, but this would need to be tougher than Teflon and completely seal itself in. Which asks even more questions like how do they eat, how do they exchange gases? It's a real conundrum, but one which warrants some serious investigation.
We are in an important time where sustainability is becoming more prominent, and people are reflecting on the way that their choices affect the planet. One big hurdle to overcome in the move towards a sustainable future is fashion. Leather has always been a popular material for shoes, belts, and jackets, but as far as sustainability is concerned, the two options, the skin of an animal, or synthetic leather, which requires plastic, both are extremely energy intensive and not particularly renewable. Researchers from the University of Vienna, however, have found a way to make a sustainable leather alternative. They have found a way to grow thick sheets of woven fungus that look just like leather. The material is mat-like and consists of thread-like root networks that fungus produce, called mycelium. Mycelium can grow on just about any organic material, ranging from sawdust to agricultural waste. And thanks to having a biological organism doing the majority of the manufacturing, there is really very little energy requirement, and fewer chemicals are required too, meaning that the environmental impact is even further reduced. The look and the feel might be right, but does this fungal leather alternative match traditional leather for durability? Apparently there is still some uncertainty about its long-term toughness, although early tests have shown that durability is pretty good. There is a lot left to explore, but fungal leather handbags, shoes, and jackets may soon be popping up in stores.
My last story, I'm afraid, is pretty sad. You may remember a while ago there were incidents of elephants mysteriously dying in Botswana. Alarms were raised in May and June when dead elephants were seen in the Okavango Delta. Poaching is always the first thought when elephants are being killed. However, these elephants' tusks weren't removed, so that was quickly ruled out. As Botswana is home to a third of the population of elephants, around 130,000 individuals, and they've already been hit hard by poaching, this was pretty worrying. Officials finally worked out what was going on. The elephants were drinking poisoned water, not poisoned by poachers, but by a neurotoxin created by microbes. Clues came when the halting of the deaths coincided with the drying out of ponds. Scientists therefore came to the conclusion that the cause of the over 330 deaths was cyanobacteria, also known as blue-green algae. In favourable conditions, cyanobacteria can grow into huge blooms, poisoning the water body they're in. Until just recently, scientists had actually ruled out the death by poison, as the blooms tend to occur near the edges of the water bodies and elephants drink from the middle. It's good that they've worked out what caused the deaths, but it has raised other questions, like why was it just the elephants and why that area only? Botswana's development of wildlife and national parks may have found the answer. Most animals drink from the surface of the watering hole. However, elephants use their trunks to collect water from deeper in the watering holes, so the neurotoxin could be present in just deeper parts of the water. So cyanobacteria will bloom in favourable conditions, for example, warm waters, it's just what they do. But like many of the world's problems, it's made worse by climate change. Also, cyanobacteria don't always produce such high levels of neurotoxin, but in the area that the elephants were affected, there was a severe drought the previous year, which may have put the bacteria under stress and caused them to produce higher levels of toxin.
And that's all we have time for this month. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Matt and I will be back next month for another episode of Micro News. If you have any comments or any suggested stories, do feel free to get in touch with us on Twitter. As always, links to all of the stories that we've discussed in today's episode will be in the podcast description below. Thanks for listening.